Your package says delivered, but delivered where exactly? The hallway? The lobby? Your neighbor's apartment? Instead of playing detective with your deliveries, get a mailbox at the UPS store. We'll sign for your packages, text you when they arrive, and keep your deliveries low-key under lock and key. Get 3 months free mailbox services with a new annual agreement at the UPS store. For full details and to get your coupon, visit theupsstore.com/offer.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Okay, here we go. This will be trying this for the sixth time. I just wanted to let you guys know how dedicated I am to quality. If I have to do this six times, I'll do it six times. Time number six. Dogs are calmed down. No one's at the door. Susan's still on the phone in the next room, but okay. All right. House is a little smaller now. That just means maybe there's a little bleed through. You probably can't even hear her. It's fine. It's fine. All right. It's first week of June. We're going to call it summer. I'm excited for the summer. I don't know why. It's always hot in LA. Summer means nothing. Summer starts in February and goes until Halloween, but still, I like summer. I'm going to be excited about it. Plus, the new house that I'm living in now has really great air conditioning. The other one did too, but this one does, and I'm excited about it. Can't wait to see how it holds up. Okay, what am I excited about? What else am I excited? I know I'm excited about some. Oh, I'm excited. I know. Look, I'm going to say that I'm excited about slow horses, but this is, I know I am late on this. Everyone has been watching this show for 2 years. We just started watching it. We got a couple seasons in. We were in the middle of season two when I got curious as to what the books were like. So I ordered book three from bookshop.org, and then that one arrived. But then we finished season two, and then I had barely started book three, which is what season three is about. So then I had to really hurry up and try to read ahead of the episodes. And Susan's like, oh God, could we just watch this? And I'm like, hold on, we can only watch up to like the first episode, and then I got to find out where I am. Anyway, we got through those sort of simultaneously. It was very confusing, but my conclusion was this. I actually think the show is better than the books, and I think the books are great. I mean, the one I read so far, very good, but I think the show, look, as someone who has adapted written material for a television show, I think they made a lot of smart decisions. Anyway, decided to stop with that. We went ahead, plowed through. We've seen all five seasons, but now I've gone back and I've bought the other four books. So I've got the first five. So I'm going to read 1, 2, 4, and 5 now that I've seen all of them. And we'll see. We'll see how it is. But I got to tell you, I do love the show. If you haven't started watching it yet, please watch it. I'm just glad that there was something that I really, really liked on the television that was not made 50 years ago. Okay, so enough of that. Tonight, it is summer. Nothing better to think about in the summer than monsters and hunting monsters. And tonight, we have Lyle Blackburn. Lyle Blackburn is an author and an adventurer, and he has spent basically his whole adult life hunting monsters in America. Not like hunting to kill, just like, you know, tracking them and trying to figure out where they live and in the meantime, writing books about them and talking to people who have had firsthand encounters. We're talking about Bigfoot. We're talking dog men, goat men. We're talking various large bipedal reptiles and frog-style cryptids, even Mothman. Now, when I was a kid, and you probably did this too, I dreamed about doing this. So Lyle is kind of living out our fantasy life, and his origin story is amazing. When he was a little kid, he saw the legend of Boggy Creek, and he was terrified. And it changed everything for him. He became obsessed with it And I love this. He went on to write what is probably the definitive book about the case and the movie. It's called The Beast of Boggy Creek, The True Story of the Fowk Monster. Now, if that isn't enough, just a couple of years ago, on a day when he really wasn't expecting anything to happen, he had his own terrifying encounter with that very monster, and he'll tell us that story on the show today. He's got a new book out called Terrifying Encounters. It's the first of a series of books that is just about firsthand accounts of people seeing things that the rest of us kind of wish we could. All right, so all of that is coming up. Hey, is it hot where you are? Wouldn't it be nice to sit back with an ice-cold beer served up in your very own RHPB pint glass? Well, good news, everyone. We've got them. You guys reached out. You said more than anything else, that was the branded merch that you wanted, so we got it. Go to Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. God, not bookshop. I know what my podcast is called. See, here's the problem. On take number 6, I've totally mistimed my martini. I'm a little too far in, but hey, we're going to get this. I know who I am. Go to Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf.com. Go to the upper right-hand corner, click on exclusive merch, get yourself a couple of pint glasses. As it turns out, they also work for margaritas and soft drinks and water if that's what you want to drink. Anyway, these are gorgeous 16-ounce pint glasses. They're RHPB branded, and you can only get them from Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf.com. Exclusive merch, so go get them. Start the summer right. Cover my face in beer foam and salt. All right, it's time for Lyle Blackburn and some truly terrifying encounters. Here we go. You sound fantastic, as always.
Oh, thank you.
And it's no coincidence that as we're recording, there is a terrifying and uncanny scratching at my door and the whining of what can only be described as a canine beast.
Oh, well, of course. That's only appropriate.
They know that this is an episode they want to be a part of. Bowie and Luna, my two dogs, they're like, wait a second. You're going to be talking about creatures like us.
Right. If they could only speak.
Oh, thank God they can't. You know, I got no interest in what they've got to say. They make their needs known without the gift of human speech. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you.
So, first of all, I feel like I want to thank you for producing this book. I'm holding Lyle's newest book, I believe, Terrifying Encounters. It is so beautiful. It is, we talked about it on the Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf Facebook group, how this is kind of the book everybody wants to be walking around, carrying it in their back pocket, you know? This is the paperback that we all had as kids. It's got that feeling. You even designed it so that it looks sort of like pre-folded and worn, like someone's already been carrying it around. It's such a brilliant insight into what people love about these kinds of books. Whose idea was it to sort of design it in this way?
Well, it was definitely my idea, and that was just coming from that same love of those old paperback pocket paperback size paranormal books that, you know, you can either, we had them as kids, and that's kind of where I started, by getting some Scholastic reader books like Strange But True by Daniel Cohen. And they were all this pocket paperback size.
Yes.
And, of course, if you go to Half Price Books or something, secondhand books, you can find these on the shelf, and they're just the perfect size and so cool. And it's gotten to be where, like, the norm of books, including all of mine, are just sort of this, they're bigger, and that's great. They have a lot of interesting content and everything, but I was like, you know what? I want to do this line of books that's like literally the same size as the pocket paperbacks. It looks like it. It captures that sort of vintage feel. And this was the perfect book to do it because a lot of my books are, they cover a single case or have a singular sort of location theme. This, I was able just to include all these random encounters I've gotten over the years that just didn't fit into the other books, ones that were, I thought, dramatic and engaging. And so that was really the criteria in this volume one, is just that they have enough content to the sighting. It can't just be, okay, it ran across the road. This needed to be significant. And I thought, what better way to do it than sort of like John Keel would have done it than, you know, just great encounters in a in an old school kind of book.
Well, that's exactly, that's the other part, is that they're, it's like they're not too long. They're just, you can pick it up, open to any page really, and within 4 minutes you've read a really scary, interesting, fascinating encounter with something. This book, this first book, covers Bigfoot creatures. And I kind of want to talk about how you categorize these, because there's Bigfoot, and then there's the anomalous apes, and then the devil monkeys. So we've kind of got, almost in descending size, the various primate ape sort of creatures, which is really interesting because I've never heard them categorized in that way. How did you come up with, okay, which one is which? And I mean, have you been hearing these things forever? Have these categories existed in your mind for years?
More or less. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, they're all essentially, they're all sort of these hairy hominids. You know, they presumably walk on two legs, are covered in hair. They're ranging in various sizes. Even when somebody says, I saw a Bigfoot, it doesn't, they're not always, you know, 8 feet tall. So for the book, I needed a way to kind of categorize them a little bit so there was chapters, not just like, here's a whole thing of just Bigfoot. And it breaks it up a little bit where people, yeah, you can pick it up and you can go, well, today I'm going to read about devil monkeys. So, which was sounds like
that's the perfect day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a day that you can learn about devil monkeys, I mean, that's a good day. But, you know, that's a category of cryptid that I knew about. And it's, you know, if you go to like any sort of cryptid website that includes like a list or category of creatures, devil monkey sort of has its own category. So I wasn't real familiar with it. And there's not a whole lot of encounters, but they're definitely different than, say, our profile of Bigfoot. These things are more baboon-like. They may or may not have tails. They're smaller. They're fearsome. And so that, and then the anomalous apes was one. I've got these ones over the years that they're like, okay, these are like Bigfoot, but they're either smaller, they're like emaciated, they're just not the same. So it made a good category to include.
Yeah, the devil monkeys had the tail that definitely seemed to be kind of the distinguishing feature. And then some of them were described as lemur-like, and I had to kind of go look at what a lemur was, but bigger than any normal lemur that we know of. And it seemed like then the anomalous apes were distinguished a lot of times by having really long arms.
Right. Yeah, that was another thing. They'd always have these exceptionally long arms. So, you know, it's splitting hairs, so to speak, is to categorize them. But I thought that's the way to do it here, and especially in these Terrifying Encounters books. And it's going to be a ongoing series. If you look on the spine, it has the number one here. So, for example, you know, I needed to have a range. I include Goatman here too, because that's sort of it. It stands on two legs. It's hairy. It generally fits this sort of category of these upright hairy creatures. So, you know, and then the next book is Terrifying Encounters, Mothman, Lizardmen, Owlmen, and other hybrid humanoids or something like that. so they'll continue on, and I needed, you know, to put like creatures in one volume, so there was enough to it, but it was still small enough, just like you say, it fits in the back of your pocket. It has that feel that I love. You can just kind of easily carry this around. You can pick it up, read an encounter. You're not committed to, okay, I'm going to open the tome and start on page one. You can just pick this up, read a scary encounter, and you know, jump around. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. So I was excited about Goatman because he doesn't seem to get, he's just not out there as much as everybody else. But certainly disturbing when you read about it, because again, you know, I'm sort of going through, I'm like, well, okay, people are seeing something. It falls into, say, the dog man category. And then what would make something goat man? And then you're reading it and people are like, no, I'm telling you, it had horns, which is so, I mean, to me is so strange. And kind of unexpected. Are there, I don't know, it's like, I want to ask, you know, are there a lot of Goatmans? And it's like, I sort of dismissed Goatman, but then I read your book and I'm kind of like, oh, I don't know, maybe none of this stuff gets to be dismissed that easily.
Right. Well, in a way, the Goatman's encounters in this book are literally the few that I can find that I believe somebody actually saw a physical sort of creature, however we would define that, where they believed they had seen something that could best be described as, you know, something that stood upright, was hairy, usually white in color, had a goat-like head or horns. And that was another reason this book worked well, because a friend of mine has written a book on Goatman, but you really have to go into the legends and folklore and all this other stuff. If you want to just talk about the sightings, you're not going to get a big chapter, but it's perfect here because it fills just enough of the book to where what you are reading is, in my opinion, the best of the best. Almost all that I could find on it where people seemed credible, and there was some very credible encounters like that policeman from Colorado and stuff. There's just not a lot of Goatman encounters.
So are people, I mean, well, first of all, one of the great things about the book is that overwhelmingly these are stories that are based on your conversations, your direct interview with the actual witness. They're not necessarily cases from history. So that I love, because that's like, oh, okay, that's like fresh material. Are people reaching out to you through your website? How do you find these people? Or how do they find you?
Well, a number of ways. Certainly I get contacted through my website with people that want to file a report that just, I guess, feel that I'm the guy that would listen to them. And that comes from just being around in this subject field for so long, you know, or if I'm on The Unexplained or Expedition X or whatever, and people see me on TV, that obviously helps to put my name out there. And then also I've done a lot of conferences over the years where I've gone and done speaking presentations and book signings and whatever. And that's a great place to meet people, because usually, you know, some people just go to a Bigfoot conference because they love Bigfoot, but a lot of people will go there because they've had an experience themselves and they want to find somebody to talk to about it, because, you know, their neighbor may or may not listen, you know.
Right.
So I meet a lot of people, and that's great because it's in person, and then I can either get the encounter there or just follow up with them if I've spoken to them and thought it was a credible one. So that's the way they come in. And so over the years, they kind of, you know, of course, I've got a lot more Bigfoot encounters than I would Goatman, but there are those unique ones that I get from time to time.
I do want to ask you about that too, but first I want to ask you what might be a strange question. I hope you don't mind answering. A lot of people talk about what it is like to speak to someone who has had one of these sightings And the sense that you get from them that, you know, the sense of authenticity that they're, you know, they're emotionally kind of affected by it. There's a demeanor to a person who has had what feels like an authentic encounter. You're hearing a lot of these stories. You're making a determination. Is there something that distinguishes to you a not real authentic story? I mean, someone who's just like, I want to get in on the fun. What kind of raises your, you know, bullshit detector to say, maybe I'm not going to include that one?
Well, you know, over the years, the more people you interview, certainly you have a good sense of what seems likely and what doesn't. And when you meet somebody in person or you even speak to them on the phone, you just get the sense that, you know, if they're a well-spoken person, usually they're kind of reluctant to tell you about the encounters, and they've come to believe that they can trust you. And a lot of times if a person that, look, I didn't believe in Bigfoot until I saw this, or I didn't believe in Dogman or whatever.
Right.
You just get the sense that this person's just telling you what they saw. You know, I mean, they're just trying to share it with somebody that will listen. And then you also get people that, you know, I mean, I'm not the be all end all, but I can tell when people, and rarely do you get the people that are saying, let's get in on the fun. You can tell the insincerity, but then you have another category of people that seem desperate to tell you. They want publicity. They want to tell you about they've seen 25 different dogmen, things that just don't ring true. Typically, I'm like, that's not, I mean, I'm happy to listen or whatever to an extent, but those aren't the kind of things that end up in my book, because I'm on an error on the side of, if it didn't seem credible to me, I don't want to add that to the documentation, you know.
I do get the feeling that people, like you said, go to the various, maybe the conferences, Bigfoot conference, something like that. And I think this happens also with conferences that cover things like near-death experiences or UFO encounters. There's a very sort of familiar story of, like you said, the reluctant person who sort of hovers at the back of the crowd, is kind of waiting, trying to decide if they want to come forward. And there is that demeanor of like, I'm, rather than me wanting to run up and tell you a story, I kind of want to approach you and see if I can describe what happened and see if I can get answers from you. Do you find that that's some of the people coming to you are, can you tell me what happened?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. You're sort of like a therapist a little bit, because they want answers. You know, they've seen something that just blows their mind or even kind of traumatize them, and they want you to help them. And of course, a lot of times all I can do is listen and sympathize with them and assure them that they're not the only ones that have seen things that other people may dismiss out of hand. I can't really give them the answers, because, you know, I wasn't there, and I can't, you know, prove any of these any more than the next guy. But I feel like they do get some benefit when they share with me, because I'm starting neutral. I'm not judging them. And at least they feel like they can get it off their chest and tell somebody who's not going to laugh. Because, yeah, you try to tell your coworker and you're likely to get a chuckle, you know.
Right. Yeah. You kind of have to go where the context of the gathering is. It's okay. We're already halfway there, so you can tell me your story, and yeah, you won't get ridiculed or, you know, accused of lying. So, I want to talk about Dogman for a second, because I feel like I didn't really know about Dogman for a long time. And then I feel like some of the first stories I heard, and sort of tell me how this, you know, if you've heard stories like this, I feel like I heard stories where people were like, I'm driving down a highway, I see a person wearing clothing. Like they're dressed like a human. And it's only when I get really, really close that the person turns toward me and their head is the head of an animal, which I thought was exceedingly strange. And then I feel like it was later that I read, you know, sort of what Linda Godfrey was writing about. And by the way, I noticed that you had dedicated this book to Linda, which is awesome. And then I'm hearing more about, oh no, it just looks like, it almost looks like a giant wolf or some sort of canine creature that is walking on all fours, then stands up on its hind legs. Have you heard the range of these stories?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And they do range between a lot of different descriptions of what people saw, you know. And Dogman's strange because, you know, say, you know, I've been doing this a long time. So say 15 years ago, I would rarely, if ever, have somebody tell me about seeing, you know, an alleged Dogman. And then just, you know, about five or seven years ago, it just all of a sudden became the most popular thing. And the Dogman is, you know, right up there with Bigfoot and, you know, in interest and just report after report. And, you know, of course, in my opinion, Linda Godfrey kind of defined what this is by doing the Beast of Bray Road case and coming at it like a journalist. So, I mean, I always, as a writer, of course, I admired her work and was fortunate to have known her. And, but yeah, now it's sort of just blossomed into all sorts of manner of stuff, whether it's the canids on all fours that stand up or whether it's just a flat out werewolf looking thing. And I'm very skeptical about it because biologically, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, canids are not built to walk upright bipedally. They're quadrupedal animals, and that their frame, their bone structure, their everything about it is meant to be on all fours. So this would be either an adaptation or these creatures are just flat out paranormal. But again, with the way I can do terrifying encounters, I was able to choose what I felt was some solid, credible sightings of what we would call dogmen and just include those rather than sort of reaching everywhere to try to include it. I just included what I felt was the best or ones that have been reported to me directly.
You guys, my dream just came true. I get to do a live read ad for a product I actually use and love. I love Indian food, okay? It's probably, after like cheeseburgers, it's my second favorite of all foods. And I love meals that are healthy, fast, and simple to make, so I love the Cumin Club. Let me tell you what this is. These things, they come in packets, you order them, they deliver them right to your home. Here's the beauty. You just add water, you microwave. These things take less than 5 minutes. An Indian entree, ready to eat. It is so delicious. Okay, so let me tell you how I do it. I started off with the paneer tikka masala, which is not overly spicy. And it was perfect for me in terms of spice level. But then I did a second one. I had it with the dal chawal, which is sort of a buttery rice and lentil dish, and I mixed them together. That was my dinner. So the next day, I did methi matar malai. You know, I'm sure I'm pronouncing this wrong. My South Asian listeners, you're going to have to tell me how badly I'm mangling this. But anyway, the methi matar malai, it's sort of a sweet, nutty cashew gravy with peas. If you've had Indian food before, I'd say this is like a korma, and it's fantastic. So I did that one with something called pav bhaj. Pav bhaj. It's a spicy veggie stew. Again, not too spicy. You don't need to be afraid. And it was the perfect lunch. Took me 3 minutes. But they've got like 20 more entrees I haven't even tried yet, so I am working my way through. When I'm sitting here writing the podcast, I will suddenly be starving. And that is my danger zone. Because that's when I will literally go into the kitchen and grab a bag of Doritos and just eat the whole thing. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. And that's why the Cumin Club is a lifesaver. Like I said, you add water, you put it in the microwave. 5 minutes later, you're eating it. It's a delicious Indian meal you can feel good about. Here's what you do. Click on the link in my show notes or simply go to thecumanclub.com and put in the offer code RHPB. That's going to get you 30% off. I'll say it again. Go to thecumanclub.com or click on the link in my show notes and enter the offer code RHPB and you're going to get 30% off. Not on your first order, not in your first two orders. You're going to get 30% off every single time you order. They're going to deliver it right to your door. Eat something good, healthy, and delicious. You deserve it. You're going to feel good about it. The Cumin Club, authentic Indian flavors straight from the source to your door. God, what am I? I'm going to go have some right now. What am I doing here? Talking about it? I'm going to go eat it.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
So can you share with us one of your favorites, either from the book or from, you know, just your history of talking to people about the Dog Man? Some of the, like, one of the scariest or strangest you've heard?
Well, the one that it's kind of one of my favorites in the book, and that's because not only because of the sighting, because of the witness. And this was one of those, and we were kind of talking about this, where I kind of put out the feelers to get some Dogman sightings while I was working on the book, so I'd have a little bit more to choose from. And this particular guy, he said that he had actually come to a Bigfoot conference in East Texas where I had been. He kind of had an interest in the subject, and he had had an experience when he was young that he never told anybody about. But he was like, you know what, I like you, and I think I would like to tell you if you want to know. So he proceeded to tell me that when he was younger, and this would have been in the late 80s, I believe, his grandfather owned some property in Louisiana, and his dad hunted out there, and he was starting to hunt when he was younger. And his dad set him up in a ground blind, and he was going to hunt on his own. You know, he's got a shotgun. He's a teenager. He's like, all right, you know, this is manly, you know, feeling good. So he goes out there, gets out there before dark, before the sun rises, and they had put out some corn mixed with peanut butter. That was sort of their trick to draw in the deer. And he also hung some doe urine from a tree. Well, he said, as the sun starts coming up, you know, starting to get light, he saw what looked like a coyote come in about 75 yards away and start coming towards that corn. And he said, as he watched it, he's thinking, it looks like a coyote, but it just doesn't look quite right. It's a little bigger. It just looks strange. And of course, the light's getting more, it's more visibility. He said the thing went to the corn and was kind of sniffing around there. And then he said the thing stood up on two legs and then walked about 15 yards over to that tree where that doe urine was hanging, gave that a sniff, kind of looked around, walked back on two legs over to the corn, started, you know, eating or messing around with that peanut butter. It did that a couple of times. Now, this guy is sitting out here. He never heard of a dog man. You know, I mean, I'm sure he's familiar with werewolves, but this is not something that comes to mind. And this is a real situation. So he was just terrified. And so he just remained quiet. And finally, this thing ended up just turning and walking off and disappearing into the trees. And he said he got down on the bottom of that ground blind and stayed for about 45 minutes to an hour before he was willing to, you know, the sun was up enough. He was willing to make a run for it. And he got out of there, and it was just something that, you know, totally scared him, traumatized him, and he didn't even want to tell his father because he thought, well, they're not going to let me go hunt anymore by myself. They're going to think I'm a baby. Well, I grew up hunting with my father, and when I was young, I would sit out there by myself. I remember being 11 or 12 and being by myself out there in a deer stand, you know, and you're familiar with the outdoors, but even then it was a little spooky when the sun started going down and you're by yourself. And I could only imagine seeing something like this, what he must have felt. And so that to me is one that's never been publicized. And I really thought this guy is very credible. He's telling me the truth. This is just what he saw.
Yeah, I love that one. And if I understand, he was in like a full enclosure. It sounded like he was like almost like in a box, like a shed sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which I think is great because in terms of being able to witness something, you're sort of set up, you're looking, you know, you're hunting. So you've got a good view in front of you. And you're totally hidden. So for a moment, you can track something and not feel like I immediately have to run. Like, that thing is weird, I'm out of here, or it's going to see me. Like, I think he knew he wouldn't be seen, so he could just observe. And I think that puts that witness in an extraordinarily unique sort of mental place to really pick up on stuff and not just be worried about, oh my God, what do I do if it looks over here and sees me? Because that's not going to happen. So I'm observing. And what I liked about that story was how he described kind of the way the legs, he's like, it didn't look like something that was most comfortable on four legs. There was something wrong about the legs that didn't make sense until it stood up. And then when it did, it wasn't like a dog. It wasn't sort of hopping. It's like, okay, now it's moving in its most natural way, which, I mean, I just think is such a compelling detail.
Right. It's just altogether unexplainable with what we know currently about canids or their biology, if that's even what it was. And so, yeah, just his descriptions rang true. And yeah, it's just one of those mind-blowing things where it's like, you know what? I can't really tell you what that was, but I can pretty much believe that this guy saw something unusual because he did observe it for so long.
Yeah. So, you know, talking about the paperbacks, I'm sure this is a familiar cover to you. Oh, yeah, I'm holding up this the Sasquatch book, the Don Hunter, Rene de Hinden. It's the yellow paperback with the Patterson-Gimlin film on the front. Again, this is like the classic from our youth. This is the thing we carry around to school that we were much more interested in reading than anything school was providing.
Right. And you know, what's really cool is this is like a, you know, when I thought up this idea, of course, I just do things because I want to do it because I like it. I have no idea how people are going to respond, or they're going to, but this book is so small, or it's not, you know. No, people love it. And I've seen people posting pictures where they'll put mine with their pile of those classics, like the one you just held up. And there's my book. They're like, it fits right in, you know. And I'm like, dude, yes, that is what I'm trying to do here. And that is so cool.
So, back in the 70s, I think you're younger than I am, but, you know, if you talked about Bigfoot, you were talking about, and it feels like the books were about a real, paws and claws, flesh and blood. This is an animal. It's out there. We're going to catch it one day, probably soon, probably in the next year or two, and then we're going to have it. And that was 50 years ago. And that has not happened yet, as far as I know. Now, 50 years later, you might pick up a book by, you know, Joshua Cutchin that's more about, well, now there's stories about Bigfoot kind of appearing the same night that people are seeing lights in the sky. And you know, we've got Skinwalker Ranch and things are coming out of portals. And a lot of these cryptids are taking on a more sort of less cryptozoological sort of aspect and more of a supernatural, paranormal, John Keel-esque thing. When you're talking to witnesses, Dogman, Goatman, you know, anomalous apes, are you hearing stuff about, you know, things that speak toward high strangeness and not just, I saw a strange animal?
Yeah, you do get those. But in fairness, it seems like all along, you would always get those standout reports where it just seems like, what? Like, yeah, man, it, you know, we shot at it and it just acted like nothing happened. Or,
yeah,
you know, just things that don't seem biologically possible. And, you know, and it's a whole conversation, you know. Of course, yeah, when I was reading those books as a young man, just sort of like, well, it's something out there, just, you know, like I go hunting for a deer, I might see it, and maybe somebody will capture one, I don't know. I still love that sort of romanticized view of, like, old school, like, explorers that can find creatures that exist that nobody knew were there. But after you go 50 years and you're like, well, there's some really great sightings and I know people have seen something. How do we explain that somebody hasn't, you know, found one laying on the side of the road or whatever? You know, you have to keep your mind open that, you know, there may be other possibilities. And the more people you interview, you realize that not everything fits into that small box. You know, there's something to this that is just beyond our understanding, I think.
Well, like you said, I mean, you grew up in a family that hunted. You know, you were familiar with guns. I mean, you were a hunter. That was the context within which, you know, a lot of your, let's go out into the forest, let's go into the woods, that's what it was about. There's something out there, it's physical, it lives, it can be shot. And it does beg that question. I know that some people who have been holding a gun when they have witnessed Bigfoot, at least, will say, I had an instinct, but then it just looked too human. Like I couldn't pull the trigger. Are there, like, does anyone ever have a gun when Dogman or Goatman shows up? Or have you also heard that sort of that weird hesitation of, I don't know what that thing is, so that's why I'm not shooting it?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, I've talked to hunters and you kind of have that thought in your mind. Like I always said, if my dad or my uncle sees one of these things, it's over. They'll shoot it. You know, they don't care. But it's one thing to think like that. But I've talked to guys that were actually hunters and things that had sightings, and overwhelmingly they say that it's a whole different thing when you see something like that that is standing upright on two legs like a person. You know, you don't want, there's no room for error, whether that's, maybe it is a person in a suit, I don't know, or the thing looks too big. What if I don't knock it down? That thing's going to kill me. So they don't, in those instances, they're like, I'm not going to shoot at that thing. And that makes sense. And that's mostly in terms of Bigfoot is where I've gotten those. With Dogman, I don't have as many reports where the person had a gun. So it was more like, you know, they were vulnerable no matter what. And then you keep narrowing that down with Goatman, and there's so few sightings, again, that less people encounter them while they're armed and ready to go. So, but yeah, it's definitely something that's probably easier said than done if you think you're going to go out. And I've known Bigfoot groups that have focused energies on, well, we're just going to shoot and take a type specimen. Well, it's not that easy. First, you got to see one. Then you got to see it long enough to put it in your sights. And then you got to make a good shot. And, you know, these things don't pose for you or become targets. So it's very hard, even if you tried to bring one down, which I don't, you know, advocate.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you, do you think in your lifetime there will be a physical specimen?
Well, I mean, I was, for many years, I thought tomorrow. And I knew some right. of these guys that were, you know, I wouldn't personally shoot one. I've gotten to where, I mean, I grew up hunting, but I'd shoot things and we'd eat it. I don't bother with that now. I just love the outdoors. And if I see an exceptional animal, great, I saw it. So I wouldn't shoot it, but again, I've known guys that had the capability, and I thought, dude, they're going to bring one down any minute. Just the call's coming, and it doesn't happen. And then I just, you know, you start to realize that not only are these things, it seems like there's a ton of sightings because there's the internet and they're all just right there, but these have occurred over a long span of time. They're rare. Your chance of seeing one, you know, beyond 3 or 4 seconds is difficult. So, you know, I just realized that so far, I think these things can elude us, and they will, and it's not that easy.
Yeah, I do find myself trying to conceive of Bigfoot as something that is less flesh and blood and somehow more akin to a ghost or a UFO. It's funny, talking to people, you know, J. Allen Hynek was the first to talk about the UFO experience. He's like, there's UFOs and people see them, but after you talk to a lot of people and you hear the stories and the words and the kind of phrases they use and the emotional aspect they have when they talk about it, it's an experience they're having. And more, I feel like there is the Bigfoot experience where people have, you know, sort of like, these are the words they use, you know, to describe their shock and their feeling about what that encounter was. Outside of just seeing an animal people don't expect to see, do people describe other strange things like, I suddenly felt very depressed or very scared or something, and then a few beats later is when I saw the thing? Do you hear that kind of thing?
You do. Usually it's like, I had the feeling of being watched. That's the number one thing. If they experience something prior to the visual sighting, usually it's the feeling of being watched. And then, you know, at the same time, often people will say they were overcome with this intense feeling of fear or dread, or even just sort of like confusion, as if these creatures are emitting, you know, infrasound or something that's not visible that's causing a reaction in the witness. So they could very well, and I mean, you know, there are animals upon this earth that can use infrasound and other things that certainly these creatures could possess that, and that causes that sort of alertness that the witness would have prior to the sighting or during the sighting that would add to it. It's not just simply I saw it. It was like I felt this dread or whatever.
I think that, like, I hear that much more in a Bigfoot report than in a grizzly bear or a black bear or something. People will tell stories about that, but it typically starts with, we're hunting and then I heard something and I looked over and there it was, a bear. It's not like suddenly everything got quiet. Then I started feeling really scared, like I was being watched. And then we saw the moose or whatever. You know, there seems to be something very unique to the kind of the whole structure of an encounter with an unknown animal. That is different. Now let me ask you this. Do you notice distinctions between people who've seen Bigfoot or Goatman or Dogman in the way they describe it? Or is it pretty much, no, it's the same except for the kind of animal they end up seeing?
I would say that the Bigfoot, there's so many reports and sightings. You just have a great cross-section to evaluate. And those do range from just, wow, I saw this thing run across the road to, oh my God, I saw this thing and it scared me to death. When you have Dogman reports, I feel like that people either experience obviously more fear. Sometimes they get the feeling that it's the creature is evil. You rarely get that with a Bigfoot sighting. Nobody really says it was evil. It's usually like it could have been intimidating, but it wasn't evil. Dogman people describe in terms of being evil. The Goat Man sightings, just, I don't know, that there's less of them. So, you know, you just don't, again, have that cross section of data to compare. So those, I don't know. People just say, this is what I saw. And usually it was brief and scary. And they're more like, what the hell am I seeing? It's more like trying to figure out just what it is you're looking at, rather than like in the Dog Man. It's like, okay, I think people's got a profile in their mind of a werewolf. And if you see that in real life, of course, you're immediately, in your cultural learning is saying, that thing is going to hurt me. It's scary. And it's got canine teeth. You know, it's probably looks some more scary than even a Bigfoot.
So in, did you read Stanley Milford's book, The Paranormal Ranger?
You know, I have not read the book, but I'm familiar with him and I'm familiar with his work and some of his sightings and experience.
Yeah. One of his earliest experiences with the paranormal is when he encountered what, you know, for him was a skinwalker, but read from a different cultural viewpoint, it sounds very much like a kind of a dog man sighting, sort of a canine-ish creature. But it is funny, the dog man stories, where there seems to be an element almost of telepathy. Like it knew what I was thinking. I knew what it was thinking. And I sort of, it was saying to me, I could kill you if I wanted to, you know, I'm not going to, but I could. And I'm kind of wondering if that is something you hear about in the reports you get. And does that play over? Like, I feel like I don't hear about that in Bigfoot sightings. Like we shared a telepathic communication. What's your experience been?
Yeah, certainly in the Dogman sightings, you'll get more of that sort of, it communicated with me, it exuded some sort of sense of dread, or it actually telepathically communicated in a more scary way, you know, rather. Now you do get people that claim that they can mind speak with Bigfoot, or Bigfoot is telepathically communicated, but typically those aren't, you know, Bigfoot's not warning you or scaring you or seemingly evil. They are maybe just more like, hey, we are forest friends. You don't bother us. We don't bother you, or something like that. Dogman, no, they're definitely, you know, scarier. And you do get a little, I guess you just get more paranormal aspects to those sightings than you do Bigfoot, at least traditionally with Bigfoot, you know.
Yeah.
And one thing this is just my thought, is that in the older days, like, you know, 40, 50 years ago, most people that researched Bigfoot or were interested in that were actually people who went out into remote and wooded environments, whether that was in the Pacific Northwest or, you know, in the Everglades of Florida, wherever. They were going in out there in the bush. Nowadays, you have a lot of what I consider people that, sure, they might go in the woods, but they're driving down to the state park and looking for Bigfoot. Not quite the same putting yourself out there. And so you just get a lot of people who may not have had as much experience in the woods that can hear things that I could explain away. Like, could you tell me all the range of vocals a fox makes? I've heard that. I've heard bears in the wild. I've come up on bears. I've seen all manner of different large predators. And you'd be surprised what other sounds animals make, what they do, and so forth. So you really have to be out there, I think, with experience to kind of rule in or rule out what is not Bigfoot. And I think a lot of stuff gets ruled in simply because we love it and we want to experience Bigfoot. So there's a lot of stuff on the internet that doesn't constitute as solid, like, yeah, that was probably a Bigfoot.
Okay, if I think I know what you're saying, because there are recordings of, okay, these are the Sonora sounds, you know, or this is the recording of Bigfoot, and you know, I haven't even researched it that much, but I know it well enough to know that it's sort of a whooping sound, you know, sort of a whoop, and then that weird low growling sort of talk, sort of like, you know. And people have talked about this, like this is sort of known as, these are Bigfoot sounds. But what do you make of that? Do you think there's more cases of misidentification, or are there recordings out there of things that even you are like, I don't know what the hell that is?
Well, certainly if you can capture some decent quality audio and be able to share that, then there is something to evaluate and others to weigh in on. And, you know, sometimes, yeah, it's been... Well, you know what? That's a bird. I mean, birds make weird sounds. That is coyotes or whatever. But there's a number of those that just cannot be explained, and those are the ones that you may categorize as Bigfoot vocalizations from the whoops and the howls. And I've heard plenty of those that are like, you know what? I don't know what that is, and my colleagues here don't know what it is either.
So you've been out there and heard these sounds yourself that you could not identify.
Yeah, that has. Yeah, in person I've heard them, you know, and I've certainly heard people submit, the audio people have submitted it. And then you do have that sort of, the whole thing about language or chatter, sort of the Sierra sounds.
Oh, the Sierra sounds, that's what I meant. Yeah, not the yeah, Sonora sounds.
Yeah, Sierra sound, like my friend Ron Moorhead, who was involved in that heavily. There's that, where there's been a few occasions where people have managed to capture what they call chatter or samurai chatter, which is theorized to be Bigfoot language or communication. And certainly, I mean, if you go to the Sierra sounds, that there is no way to explain that. That is something that just simply cannot be explained. And on the occasions, rare occasions, where somebody's caught some of that on audio that's similar, yeah, those are compelling and amazing. So I think it's just a matter of, like, people being able to capture something that has something to evaluate and something that goes beyond just the simple stories. And those are great, too, and stuff. But if we're going to really prove it... with any of these cryptids, you know, it would take more evidence.
You know what? How about making 2026 the year that changes everything? A lot of you have reached out asking for help with your personal creative projects. So finally, after 30 years in the business, I'm making myself available really to whoever needs help. Maybe you're writing a TV pilot or a movie. Maybe you're trying your hand at memoir. You want to tell the story of your life, kind of like this podcast. Or maybe it's a novel or a short story or a graphic novel. Look, whatever it is, they say endings are hard, but really getting started is even harder. And that's where I come in. Go to richardhaddam.com and click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room. I can help you with brainstorming sessions. Maybe you're halfway through something and you're stuck. I can read what you've got so far, help you bring it to the finish line. Or I can read a finished script or a story and help you get it into professional shape so you can finally send it out into the world. Go to richardhaddam.com, click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room, and let's get to work. Mention that you heard about it on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and you'll instantly get a 20% discount, okay? Working with me isn't free, it's not even cheap. But it's worth it. Don't wait any longer. Now's the time to make your dreams come true. Get unstuck at Richard Haddam's Writer's Room at richardhaddam.com. So when you were a kid and you were reading these books, did you imagine a future in which you would spend your life exploring these questions?
No, it never even crossed my mind. I mean, I just thought, you know, there's no job or pursuit right. Or career in it, you know. But in a very surreal way, the way it has happened is that, you know, I loved those books when I was a kid. I read them and, you know, wanted to see one of these creatures. And I, as a hunter, you know, I kind of was like, I could, but I live in Texas. And at the time, I didn't know about any Bigfoot sightings. But when I, we went camping a lot, and we would go into Arkansas. And on one occasion when I was young, my parents took me to a drive-in theater, and we saw the old movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek, which came out in the 70s and dramatized sightings of a Bigfoot-like creature in this small town of Falk, Arkansas, which was only 3 hours or so from where I lived in Fort Worth, Texas. So at that point, I thought, oh, wait a minute. Maybe not only do I have the possibility of seeing one, but of being killed, because this thing was scary in the movie. But fast forward, the surreal part is that that's what got me into this as an adult, because I loved that movie so much, and it was based on true sightings, that I set out to write a book on the sightings behind The Legend of Boggy Creek and what went into making that film. And then when that book came out, suddenly I was being called by Animal Planet and, you know, Monsters and Mysteries in America that were covering similar stories, or the Falk Monster story. And then suddenly I became part of the Legend of Boggy Creek in a way. And I've since worked on reissues of the movie on Blu-ray and remastered versions, and done commentary tracks, and been on countless shows talking about. So, yeah, I could have never imagined as a kid watching that movie, which is pretty much my favorite movie ever, I would actually be somehow the spokesperson or even involved in any way. And so it's very surreal.
It's such an interesting movie. I had literally never seen it until like 4 months ago.
Oh, wow.
And I kept hearing about it, but for some reason, and it was on TV when I was a kid, but I was just sort of like, oh, I don't know. For some reason, I don't know why, but it was sort of like, well, that's sort of just outside of something that it's like, I've got to see. But then, like, over the course of years, and then even weirdly more recently, enough people brought it up that I'm like, okay, I have to fill this in now. It's like when you're a film major and years go by and it's like, I still haven't seen Casablanca. I just got to sit down and watch this thing, you know? So I watch, and I'm up in my room, up in the bedroom, and my wife, Susan, comes in. And she's like, well, what's this? I'm like, okay, look, I'm just starting it. We don't have to watch it. It's The Legend of Boggy Creek. I've never seen it. She's like, no, go ahead. You know, so then we start watching, and then she starts getting involved. It's the weirdest movie. It is such an odd blend of tones and forms. It's part, like, it starts out like it's going to be this is a story of my childhood, you know, and this, you know, sweet music's played, John Denver, it sounds like, you know? And it's just, and then it gets weird. Then they're interviewing people. Then there's actually like stage sequences. And it's just like, and then the last 10 minutes are terrifying. Like that last sequence with those people at night, it's like, oh, damn. It's like the Boggy Creek monster is, he's not fucking around anymore. He's coming after him. So I totally get how how that would have an effect. And plus also it's close to home, and you're like, oh, this isn't just Oregon and Washington and Canada. This could be right near where I live.
Yeah. It scared me to death. And I had, you know, being hunting, we were always out in some rural area. We had passed by little creepy small towns, you know, every one of them. I'm like, oh dude, they look creepy to me anyway. And I'm thinking, these people got a monster in the woods, you know? So yeah, it was in the movie in many ways. It, of course, it's dated. I mean, this was early 70s when it was made, but it was the template literally to everything that we watch now on paranormal or cryptid television shows. It did the reenactments. It interviewed the people, you know, it talked a little history about the town. It was like, you know, all these shows owe that a gratitude to director Charles Pierce, because he kind of established that sort of, here's how it's done. There's a scary encounter, and here we got the witness to talk to, and we're going to reenact it. And so it's an amazing movie, and just I've dissected it over the years. Like, I know where all that stuff took place. I know who had the original sighting, how it translated to the movie, just total geek. Like, I'm geeked out on it so much that I know all those details.
How are people still seeing the Falk Monster?
Oh yeah. I mean, I get that question. I still see that on the internet, but you know, they obviously haven't read my books, because I've talked about sightings. My Boggy Creek casebook goes from 1908 to present. Well, that cut off in 2020. So up to there.
Oh, okay. But that's,
sightings since. And I've, of course, and nowadays I interview the people and I can go and talk to them. And so, yeah, there's still a good handful of credible sightings each year, and it's ongoing, because those Sulphur River bottoms that you saw in the movie, they still exist just like that. I mean, you can go in there, and a lot of that, it literally looks exactly the same as it did in the film. It hasn't been developed. And I, even I've had a sighting, well, several sightings down there, but one that I could say, I believe I saw that thing. So
is that the most vivid sighting you've had? Or is there one that stands out as this is the high water mark for something that you have personally experienced?
That was the best sighting, because the others were, I had a brief one of something that was red in color, which I can't say 100% because it was further away and I couldn't see it well enough. And then I chased something through the Ocala National Forest that I believe might have been a skunk ape, but I chased it and it just stayed ahead of me just enough in that brush that I never could catch it. And it eventually I had to give up because I was getting so far out there I was going to be lost. But
well, tell us about the Falk Monster sighting, because I think I saw you talking about it on YouTube a little bit. But how did that come about? When was that? What happened?
That was in April of 2024, and I did a piece on it on my YouTube channel to show people location. But essentially what happened was, is to make a long story short, I had been up there some months prior to this and found some hog skulls that I thought maybe somebody arranged, but it was weird to find a pile of hog skulls. And I mentioned that, and a friend of mine said, well, we had been up there and we found a whole bone pile of not just hog bones, feral hogs, but deer, which I thought was odd that somebody would throw deer bones. You know, usually hunters take and process deer. But anyway, I thought, well, that's interesting. That gives me something to look for. So I was up there in Falk, and myself and a friend of mine who does some field research with me and my girlfriend went out looking for this so-called bone pile, which was sort of by this very swampy looking lake with the cypress trees and the Spanish moss. I mean, it looks like right out of the movie, and it hooks around towards the Sulphur River, where there's this just big remote area. And we started in the afternoon, and we walked, and you know, I'm traipsing through that deep mire and looking, and we never saw the bones. Possibly the water had risen up in the time, because it had been like 4 or 5 months since these guys had so-called seen that. But anyway, so it was getting towards evening, and we were like, man, we got to head back. You know, we've been walking out here a long time. We were kind of they were kind of walking back by this little creek that ran adjacent there. There's a lot of mud, so we just looked for tracks and stuff. And I saw a game trail that kind of went up on a little bit of an incline, and it was wide open. And for whatever reason, I just decided to walk up it, because probably because it was easy to walk. And I usually try to be quiet and move around. I don't make a lot of noise. You know, I'm a hunter. I just like to blend in with the woods. But I started walking up that, and I heard something to my right, maybe 30 yards off. I heard what sounded like crunching in the brush, and I turned, and first I see something dark coming out of the low part of the brush, which I immediately took, I thought it was a feral hog. I've seen a lot of big feral hogs back there. But within a second, this full figure came out from behind those trees and walked into an open space. And this thing was upright. It was on two legs. It was uniformly dark in color. And in those few seconds, you know, you go from it's a hog to, oh, it's a person. It's walking. No, that's not a person. It is not wearing clothes. It's dark. And it walked, I saw it for about 3 or 4 seconds as it went between some trees and it, out into this open, just very short open space, and then disappeared behind the brush. And then I just literally remember thinking, oh my God, I just saw what all these people have reported. And so I had two options at that point, which would be either run after it so I could see it longer, which I would have done had normally, but I had two people here and I thought, man, there's no way it can get away without them seeing it. So I took option two and kind of went down. They were about 20 yards off and I hurried down there and tried to explain as fast as I could what I'd seen. And, you know, of course they're like, what? I'm like, shush, you know, I'm like, and then they quickly realized this was not a joke. And then we just sort of grid search style started going off that incline and walking back to where I'd last seen it. And in that process, we were kind of, you know, being a very observant, and we got down in there where I believe it kind of went out of sight, and we didn't see it. Whatever it was, I can only assume that it probably heard me in the time frame, and if heck, it probably already knew we were there. I don't know. It didn't look at me when it walked by. It was in profile, and it never even looked at me. It may not have known I was there, but it may have heard them because they were kind of talking. But anyway, I just can only speculate that whatever it was just had heard us and just, you know, darted off in a direction unknown. We looked for tracks, but it was a lot of leaf litter there. We couldn't see any tracks, and we looked around for another, you know, 30 minutes at least and never saw it, but it was just that fast.
How close were you when you saw it?
It was only maybe 30 yards. It was quite close. And if it hadn't been, you know, there's a lot of thick woods back there. If it hadn't have been for those trees, you know, I could have observed it for longer, but it was just, it just kind of came only out into that open spot for 3 or 4 seconds before I couldn't see it again. And of course, the thing was dark. So when it goes into that brush, it's hard to tell what's a shadow and what's not, you know, it was very camouflaged, but it was pretty close.
And any sense of height?
Well, I kind of had an impression that it wasn't that tall, but then when I sort of compared that to my friend's height and you put that 30 yards off, then I realized, man, that was much taller than a person.
Okay.
And a friend of mine, Chester Moore, which I saw shortly after that, it's kind of a big, he was taller than me. I was like, and I'm looking at him like, it was taller than you. So I would say 7 feet, but definitely that's a estimate. Definitely bigger than an average person, but I couldn't say exactly how tall.
Wow. That is so great. And did you, when you had that sighting, how'd you feel?
Well, the adrenaline pumps and you feel excited. And then of course I felt let down when I thought surely they can see it. And then, cause who's going to believe Lyle Blackburn saw, you know, the Falcon monster, nobody's going to believe it. So I'm thinking,
right,
man,
exactly.
If they see it, you know? So, you know, you feel like this is great. And then you're disappointed. And then when you come away from it though, you're going, you know what? I felt like I had the opportunity to see you know, something that maybe very few people did, even if it was for a short time. And then it just fires me up to want to go back more because I'm like, okay, now, you know, I got to see it for longer. I want it to come and stand in the road for a while, you know.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that first taste. Now, yeah. Now you got to go back.
Yeah.
You're jonesing for more Falk Monster. I don't blame you.
Right. So, you know, but I didn't have time to feel scared. And I, you know, my friends were there. Maybe I'd have been spooked out if I was on my own, but I still,
right.
It would never affect me like in any way where I would be afraid to go in there. I carry a sidearm, but that's really just because there literally are cougars down there and giant gators and feral hogs. But, you know, I feel like I know what I'm doing in the woods, which may help, but I definitely feel excited still about it and want to go back and to try to, you know, get a better look and to take a photo. People are like, how come you can't get a photo? I'm like, dude, I barely had time to see the thing, much less take a photo, you know.
It's hard to take a photo of anything. You if you go outside your house and someone says, take a photograph of a squirrel, you could go all day and not get a good one. And they're everywhere. But it's very weird. I know I'm familiar with that talk, but it's also the other thing is the phones that we carry around with us are not designed to record what's actually there. It's constantly adjusting to get a really good shot of you and your friends at Disneyland, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's changing the light. It's doing things that actually doesn't necessarily help you accurately capture what it is you're seeing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I've got a good buddy here in Texas. His name is Russell Graves, and he is a wildlife photographer, and he shoots for Texas Monthly. And I mean, dude, he gets the most amazing photos of wildlife. But in order to do it, he has to put in a lot of hours, and he's also got a camera that can capture the moment. And that camera is big, and it's costly, and yeah. It's not some little phone. And you know, so unless... Now, if he sees one, we're going to get a really, really good picture, which is ironic so because great. His brother had a sighting of what I would call an anomalous ape. It wasn't exactly a Bigfoot. It was in a tree. Maybe it was even a devil monkey, but his brother saw it, but Russell's never seen anything, and he's the guy with the great camera. See, oh, that's the irony.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So, okay, so this book is out. People can get this book. And I definitely recommend that you do. It's so fun and it's just exactly what you want. It's like all dessert, no vegetables. It's so fun. Now, when's the next one come out? When does Mothman, Owlman, Lizardman come out?
Right. I know. I realized that when somebody said, hey, I just got your book. I read it yesterday. I'm like, oh, man. You know, you take 6 months to write a book and they read it in one day, which is a compliment. But my plan is to have it the next one out in July. It's already written. And that's the other beauty of these smaller books. You know, you get your fix sooner than if I've got to write a giant, you know, case book.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I should point out this first printing, I did this sort of old school as well. It is a bulk print job. This isn't on demand. I mean, I had it printed at a printer. The first pressing was 500 copies, and it's only available from me on my online store at lyleblackburn.com. You can't get it on Amazon, at least for now. So if you want to get in on this legendary first printing, which I only have about 180 left already. So get it quick.
Are they all signed? Because mine is signed.
Yeah, when you order from my website, any of my books from there, definitely, they're all signed. So you're going to get something that's like first pressing, signed. You know, you can sell that later on eBay for $1 million, of course.
That's right. You buy a bunch so you can keep one and then sell the others.
Right.
Get the book. It'll be signed. Collect them all. I mean, that's the other genius part of this is that it's like, if you buy one, you're already 50% invested in getting the next one because you want them both, and then you want the next one and the next one. This is a genius idea. It totally delivers. So thank you for doing it. Jonathan Dodd is the artist. He does an incredible job. This picture on the cover is just like, I don't believe that that's what anyone, it looks like This is a dog man who's been working out and taking steroids. He's very shredded, very attractive, but also looks like he's going to kill you.
Right. Yeah. Jonathan captured the perfect best specimen of dog man that we could find and illustrated it. So yeah, it's awesome. So he's going to work on the next cover and the books great. The books only get weirder and more interesting because I'm already working on book three, which I'm not going to say what's included there, but it's getting scary and weird, and it's really fun to be able to, just put out what I think are the most terrifying and best encounters with these creatures and share, my love of these retro books with everybody else. And I'm so glad that you get it. Like I'm like, yes, you get it. And it's like, I had no idea if people would, like I said, would respond, but it's been overwhelming that people love this retro vibe,
Oh yeah, I know. My listeners, they totally get it, and they're into it. They're into the physical media, the physical book, and this especially. Lyle, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been so great. And then let's talk again when the next one comes out. I mean, I haven't seen Mothman, but I'm interested in people who have. So I want to read about those guys and talk about that.
Absolutely. I even have a Mothman witness that I interviewed first person. That her incident, it hasn't been published in print. So, I'm trying to get the best here for volume two.
All right. That is great. Thanks again, man. We'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate you. See ya.
Bye.
Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazzaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.